There's a seems to be a native Hawaiian expression that goes something like holding the seed or nourishing the seed, building the seed. And the way it was introduced to me was the idea that there is a seed within us, some kind of interior life, which perhaps is quite small, that somehow we would be the custodians of, we would safeguard it, we would nourish it, and that we would somehow be connected to this part of our inner life in a way that certainly we'd stay in touch with it, but also somehow nourish it along and support it and let it grow. And the image of a seed, of some inner seed that we all have, seeds, appears in many traditions, certainly in Buddhism also. Intentions are understood to be seeds. And seeds are usually something quite small, something small that can grow into something large. And seeds often are quite vulnerable, and I think a lot of plant seeds don't make it. A few of them actually survive and grow into plants. And so the same way in our inner life, there are seeds there of something, various things, that can either perish or it can be supported and grow into something beautiful. And that perhaps the seeds within us, when they're really teeny, are perhaps not only fragile, but also quite shy and easy to overlook, not to notice and not to support. And I think it's very easy to kind of have an exterior life, to focus on exterior aspects of life, and lose in touch with something which might be initially very small and seed-like, and so it never has a chance to flourish and grow. The idea of nourishing a seed within us, some interior aspect of our life, in my mind is also connected to the idea of, I don't think I have the vocabulary for it exactly, so bear with me, but something private. Something private that you don't necessarily share with other people. You might if you'd like, but sometimes not sharing with other people or being very careful when and how we share this interior life with other people supports and can nourish some of the seeds within us. I remember when I practiced with my first Zen teacher, we would have practice discussions about various things, and the instructions back then was you shouldn't really talk to other people, other students, about what happened in practice discussion. Now, that could lend itself to various kinds of odd things, but the way I understood it was that that somehow when you talk too casually about the aspects of your inner life, that somehow it disperses its specialness or its a certain kind of focus that can happen when we keep it private to ourselves, certain kind of way in which it percolates or digests or moves within us. And if we're too quickly to share aspects of our inner life to other people, then sometimes it actually kind of weakens it, or lets it kind of, or I don't know if it weakens it maybe, but it kind of detracts from the way in which our inner attitudes, inner way of holding it, supports and nourishes it. So some way of maintaining an interior life, some interior focus, holding something inside of us, so it's nourished and supported, something delicate and something to be cherished and loved, and not treated casually or coarsely or kind of displayed for the world just to kind of see to in all kinds of ways, but maybe in some ways kept a little bit lovingly private or interior, so that it can grow and nourish. Maybe it's not ready to be shared with other people until it's become quite strong. So to keep it in ourselves and not take the first opportunity to share it with other people. I think in California sometimes there's a great sharing culture. And let me share with you what's really important for me. And sometimes I think we do ourselves a disservice to share too quickly. And perhaps other people don't need to know that we are trying to cultivate truthfulness, or trying to cultivate a certain kind of level of compassion or care, or a certain intention of kindness, or a certain intention of being at peace with ourselves. There's a whole range of things we might be trying to nourish. Maybe we don't have to tell people that until maybe much later as it gets stronger and gets more developed. It gets strengthened, it gets fed by maintaining that interior life. And I think meditation is certainly one of those ways of supporting a kind of interior life and nourishing it. And meditation is usually something when you're meditating you don't share with other people. It's something for yourself. Oh, there was, when I studied religion in at university, one of the great exercises was to try to figure out a good definition of what religion is. And a lot of people have come up with different definitions, and then students would study them all and critique them and all that. And in the end, realize no one could really come up with a definition of what religion is. But one of my favorite definitions of religion is was something like the relationship a person has with what is most ultimate when, let's see, in the privacy of that person's own life. When a person's alone and there's no other people around, the relationship a person then has to what's ultimate, that's where the religious life is found. Now, there's problems with that definition also, but I liked it because, you know, when no one's looking, how do you behave? When no one's looking, what's most important for you? And what are the values that are deep inside of ourselves when no one's looking, when we're not doing something for other people? So in the Buddhist tradition, there's a teaching about the four nutriments, the four foods. And the four foods is that which sustains and supports life. And it's not breakfast, lunch, dinner, and snacks. It's, though sometimes I think in Buddhism that the three treasures, the three refuges, is not the way Buddhists eat. It tends not to be Dharma, Sangha, Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, but breakfast, lunch, and dinner. I've never eaten so well, usually, as I have in Buddhist centers. But the idea of the four nutriments, the background for it is that the human being, who we are, is not a fixed entity. We're not kind of some fixed thing, we're born, that's who we are. But rather we're continually a process which is recreating itself, reinventing itself, remaking itself. It's an activity which just gets constantly fueled. And unless this activity of being a human being gets fueled, then will just fade away, it'll die. And that, but how it gets fueled depends on the outcome. So if you eat a lot of junk food, then there's a certain outcome. If you eat a lot of healthy food, it has a certain outcome. And so part of Buddhism is to be caretaker, be careful with the kind of food we take that nourishes and supports life, our life as it's lived. So there's four foods. And the first two of the foods have to do a little bit more with the external world, our relationship to the world around us. And the second two foods have to do with what's inside of us, the food that which is self-nourishing, that which we can nourish ourselves from what's inside. The first is physical food. And I take that to mean any of the ways in which we take care of our physical being, not just with food, but also with exercise and rest and various things like that. And that we need to kind of nourish ourselves with good, healthy food. We need to nourish ourselves with the proper amount of food. The Buddhist tradition puts a tremendous emphasis, the early tradition, on eating in moderation, which meant don't overeat. And partly that's because it supports meditation practice. If any of you try to meditate after eating a huge feast, it doesn't work very well. So to eat in moderation is something that supports meditation. But my suggestion is that what I found is that eating with some moderation helps maintain a connection with a healthy kind of interior life. That when I overeat, I'm still connected to some kind of interior life. But it's not one that's very vital or exciting or interesting. It's kind of like heavy and dull, and you know, I don't know how it is for you. But it has, you know, so there's the obvious thing of eating well, eating good food that supports us, and then there's doing things like exercising, and enough. You know, you look at the teachings of the Buddha, and nowhere that I've come across does he recommend exercise. You know, there's an eightfold path. There isn't right exercise as part of the eightfold path. But I suspect that's because back in ancient India, the Buddha and his monastics and people, he walked everywhere. You know, if you walk as much as the Buddha walked through India, you don't need to get any more exercise. It's kind of like given. It's kind of taken for granted. So it wasn't really needed, that kind of instructions. You know, the Buddha, when he was 80 years old, walked something like 400 miles. At that age, still walking, still very, able to do that. And I feel sometimes, the kind of teachings that I give here, that I never really talk about exercise and maintaining the physical body in some healthy, balanced way. The Buddhist teachings mostly don't talk about that. And it's kind of, I think what best to take it as being, that's a given that we're supposed to do that. That's like a given kind of, you're supposed to have a certain basic level of being able to take care of yourself in order to do Buddhism. And once you have that in place, then you can talk about doing other things like meditation practice. And one of the things is eating well, and the other is exercising properly, getting enough, being toned well, having the body working well, getting enough rest. As I like to say, some people in America need to sleep more than they need to meditate. They're a sleep-deprived culture. The second of the foods, which again has to do with more the external world impacting us, is called sense impressions, the perceptions we take in from the world around us. And the impressions we take in affect who we are, feed us, nourish us, change us, condition us who we are. And it doesn't take a lot of reflection to realize that there are people who have paid a lot of money in our culture to bombard us with sense impressions to affect our behavior and who we are. Advertisements, for example, are great at doing that. Just the right color of blue or whatever it is that, so that to get people to buy more. Or just the right kind of, physical body who is, you're selling paper clips, right? And so, they have a sexy body that's selling paper clips. And you think, if you get that paper clip, then you too will be that sexy. And so we're seduced by these, the images that come in, the sense impressions that come in. If we're not careful with how we take in sense impressions and have some wisdom about what we're taking in, then there can be almost like an unconscious or subconscious way in which it conditions and affects who we are. It feeds our system. It feeds what goes on inside of us. And it can be healthy feeding and not so healthy feeding. So the Buddhist tradition puts a lot of emphasis on what's called safeguarding the senses. Watch what happens at the sense level, at the perception level, and then safeguard ourselves. There's something precious going on inside of us. There's something very, very important. And how the world comes in, how we take the world in, how we see the world, will affect our inner life. So safeguard that inner life, the quality of your inner life, by being careful what you take in. You see a billboard going down 101, and it has the latest, gadget? Watch what your mind does. It might do nothing and you go on, which is great. Or it might pick it up and you might think, well, how can I get that? Can I get, I'm not that far from fries. And if I just, rush down there, I won't be too late for my meeting. And they won't mind too much, but I'll have to rush. And so suddenly the quality of inner life, gets changed dramatically because we've taken it in and we haven't been so conscious of safeguarding ourselves, caring for ourselves at that level of the senses. There's also choosing more appropriate perceptions or senses for us that are more supportive and feed us in useful ways. I'm fond of a little story of when the Buddha was going to... the Buddha's son, he had one child who was a son named Rahula. And at some point, his son joined the monastic order, and I guess to study with his father, also to be a monk. And he did it as a relatively young boy. And there's a very touching story of when the Buddha felt his son was ready to receive some of the deepest teachings he had to offer. He called his son and said, come with me. And he took him very intentionally deep into the woods to a place that's, we still know the name, it's called Blind Man's Grove. And he took him into this woods, and there they sat on these roots of trees. You have these tropical trees in India, and they have huge trees, where they have these big, like banyan trees. I don't know what they're called, those big exposed roots. Do they have a name, the exposed roots of trees? Probably some of you have seen them. What? Well, those are the ones kind of hanging. These are the big exposed ones that are kind of sitting on the ground, that come out of the ground, kind of like make walls almost. And anyway, the Buddha went deep into the woods with his son and sat him there on the root, on this big arrow, these big exposed roots, and then gave him these liberating teachings that he had to give. And there's something about going deep into the woods, in the intentional aspect of that, and the significance, the stillness of the woods, the solitude of the woods, perhaps the very, very different way in which the senses are impacted by the environment in the woods than in other places, that the Buddha felt this was the most conducive place to let this deep teachings go into his son's heart. There's a teaching in Buddhism that's called the asavas, which one way of translating it is to call it the drains, that which drains us. And certain things that we do, certain kind of impressions, certain kind of activities, drain our vitality. And other things support it and vitalize it. And so, and sometimes it's not so clear until after the fact. I've watched television sometimes. I've watched very, very little television in my adult life. But sometimes I've watched television and thought I enjoyed it while I was watching it, but found at the end of the time I watched television that I felt really awful, like I had too much to eat or something. I kind of lethargic and a little bit kind of vibrating in a funny way. And so it kind of drained me, you know, that activity. Certain conversations that I've had, the way I participated in the conversation, I felt drained by the end, instead of vitalized and energized by the experience. So to safeguard the senses, to safeguard the way in which we relate to the external world and how the external world relate to us, is part of a wise life in Buddhism. It's not to be aversive to things and not to shut off and be numb to the world around us, but be very attentive at that juncture between the external world and the internal world and watch what we do there. It's not really a problem with the external world as much as it is how we pick it up and how we relate to it. So they live there. And that's part of the reason why we put a lot of emphasis on being in the present moment. Because it's in the present moment where we get this impact on our senses and the world, and then we can safeguard how that is. The third of the foods, nourishments, nutriments, is our intentions, our motivations. And this is what's called a seed, often in Buddhism, the seeds of our intention. And that requires first being interested in our intentions and motivation, and spending time clarifying it and deepening our intentions. It's very easy to have superficial intentions, motivations. It's very easy to adopt the motivation society tells us we should have. But to really spend time, private time, with ourselves, really kind of trying to get deep inside of ourselves and really reflect deeply, what is my intentions? What are my deepest intentions? What's the orientations around which I want to orient my life that have deep meaning, that have not the meaning simply, you know, get me through the next day, or, you know, set up some basic level of security and well-being in my life, but something when I come to the end of my life, I can look back and feel some deep sense of well-being and satisfaction for having oriented my life around those intentions. The intentions that we carry with us are food. No matter what the intention is that you live by, it is a kind of food for our inner life, for our being, for our life. And the quality of that intention then affects us just the same way the quality of our food, physical food, affects us. Do we take responsibility for the intentions that we live our life by? And I suspect when I look around society that a lot of people don't take that much responsibility for it. If we get angry very quickly and yell at our kids or our family or someone, was that done automatically, habitually? Or was it done with real care and attention to the intentionality behind it? The motivation, what motivated it. If we want to be a safeguard of our intentions and motivation, then perhaps there's something else we want to motivate, act from, than hostility or anger or frustration or impatience. And this is where it comes to this, it comes up with this idea of something very shy within us, something very small within us. Sometimes the seeds of compassion, the seeds of patience, the seeds of peace, are something which, you know, is so quickly swamped or flooded over by some of the habitual responses that can bubble up inside of us. And it takes some effort, it takes some care to stay in touch, to nourish, to be calm enough and peaceful enough or still enough, non-reactive enough, to stay in touch with some of the shyest seeds within us. Sometimes it requires us not looking so good. Sometimes it means not acting and then seeing, well, appearing to people as being maybe indecisive because you didn't act so quickly. But maybe what you're doing, rather than acting quickly because you don't know how to act in a wise way, you're just trying to stay in touch with something which is very precious inside of you and let that nourish and grow, and then later, perhaps, you'll know how to respond wisely to situations. So are the intentions that we act on ones which are conducive to peace, harmony, love? Or are they intentions which are conducive towards alienation or separation between people or hostility or you know, all kinds of things which don't really support us? The quality of the intention we have is measured not so much by the effect it has in the world outside of us, but rather the effect it has within us. And so we're not necessarily safeguarding our best intentions so that other people benefit, though I hope they do, but we're safeguarding it for ourselves so we benefit. If we act out of anger and aversion, someone else out there might be hurt by it. Maybe that's the intention. But we also are hurt by it. The Buddha said something like, when we act out of anger towards our enemy, we do our enemy a favor. Because we've caused harm to ourselves, which our enemy could not have done. So we're really getting in there to the interior life. So to be careful with the intentions and have some kind of way in our life to spend quality time reflecting on our intentions, looking at it, being with it. And I like to encourage people to spend some time every day, and sometimes I say it's more important than meditating, to spend some time every day reflecting on what your deepest intentions are. How is it you want to live your life? What's the most important orientation or values that you want to live by as you go into your life? Reflecting on it every day, massaging that question every day, looking at it every day, going deeper. Behind that intention, what motivates that? What's that? What's that further back? Sometimes people, when you ask them their deepest intention, they'll formulate it in a negative way. They'll say something like, to not live selfishly or not live being afraid or something. But it's always interesting to turn that kind of negative question around and state it positively. What's the positive formulation of your deepest intention? And when I've done that in my life, I found that it fascinating to watch how it morphs and changes over the days and weeks and months that I've kind of investigated this question. What is my deepest intention? How do I want to live my life? A variation of that question, which I've had for myself, is if I knew that I was going to die tonight, how would I live the rest of the day? And that was also very interesting to see how that changed over time and over the months and the years, actually, I kind of did that exercise. The fourth food is that of what's called consciousness. And consciousness has a variety of aspects. One aspect is that it has to do with the quality of our inner life, kind of the general mood or quality of our consciousness, of our psyche. So it's a little bit broader than just the intention. So to safeguard the quality of being calm, or being clear, or being kind, or being patient, or being somehow settled. There's some kind of sense of inner well-being. Just safeguard that. And I know that a sense of inner well-being can be a small little seed that's very shy. And sometimes people overlook their own sense of well-being because they're focusing on everything that's going wrong in their life, the problems in their life. But to relax and kind of look between the cracks of everything that's going wrong and seeing, is there some well-being here? Can I find a little bit? Just a little hint of it. And then to nourish that little seed. If we're always focusing on what's wrong and never nourish the little seed of well-being, that seed of well-being will never sprout and grow. If we're always focusing on the problems in our life, that's what gets fed. Don't ignore the suffering of the life, but look at how it's being held and what it's nourishing, what it's supporting. And perhaps the proportions need to be changed a little bit. And I think a lot of people would do really well to look for the sense of well-being in themselves, the quality of their being, and then to maintain it, to safeguard it, to support it, to nourish it. What does it take to stay in touch with it, to be with it? Another aspect of consciousness, which I think is, for me, is very significant, is that consciousness itself, the simplicity of the most simple aspect of consciousness, that of awareness, that of just receiving a sense impression, receiving experiences of the world, of kind of the screen of awareness upon which things occur, in a sense, is something which is a kind of a food if we know how to tune in to the quality of that simple awareness. That simple awareness has the qualities of peace. It has the qualities of non-conflict. It has qualities of spaciousness. It has qualities of having no location. It has qualities of being inclusive. Everything's included within it. It has no outside. It has these wonderful qualities in and of itself that if we stay in touch with it, is self-nourishing or is a kind of food which helps generate a liberated life, a free life, a compassionate life. So part of relaxing deeply in meditation is to begin to get a sense of the nature or quality of this luminous awareness, luminous consciousness, this consciousness which is transparent, this awareness which is not for or against things, this awareness which is not caught up in the objects of awareness, what we know of, not trying to manipulate the world or understand the world, but the kind of the place of awareness which is kind of like the space of this room. You know, to be aware of the space in the room between the people here, between the walls, and to realize that awareness is somehow like this space. The space in this room is not troubled by the people who are sitting in it. When you saw all of you stand up in a few minutes to leave, the space doesn't care. You know, it just holds it all peacefully. So awareness is the same way. It doesn't matter what pops up in awareness, what stands in awareness, or what appears or disappears. Awareness has this quality of very, very deep peace that so much of what we normally think important in life disappears within it. So a couple of simple things about how to maybe nourish in inner life, the seeds within us. And probably maybe some of you have, maybe we can ask in a few minutes for your ideas of how to do it. And I'll give you a couple of small ones that come to mind for me. One thing I like to do is to get up early. I like to get up ideally at 5 o'clock in the morning, 5:15. And that, just that time alone before my family wakes up. And there's something about the stillness, the quality of that peaceful time early in the morning that lends itself to kind of being in touch with some inner life or some stillness in life or some spiritual quality of life. And to have that quiet time in the morning, it really nourishes me a lot. I like going for walks alone. Spending time alone it nourishes me a lot. I like going for walks alone and letting my thoughts wander and reflect and see what's in my thoughts, what my concerns are. And sometimes pick up certain themes and reflect on them and look at them deeply, like my intentions. Sometimes I like to have particular conversations with friends when the conversations can somehow reflect or speak from or speak about or nourish this part of myself which I think is most intimate and most deep. And it can't just be any old friend or it can't just be any old way of being with a friend. But it has to be a certain kind of way where we're both kind of sitting calm, settled, in a certain kind of way. I remember once driving from here down to Yucca Valley with a very good friend of mine who'd done a lot of meditation practice. And we talked a lot, maybe too much the whole time down there, actually. But we talked about all kinds of things. But when, by the time we got to where we were going after 9 hours or something, I realized that the conversation was leading someplace. And slowly we led each other, until finally, you know, after 8 hours of driving and talking, we were both talking about some of the deepest aspects of our spiritual life that we could share with anybody. And it was really something to have come to that place where it made sense, almost like palpable in the conversation in the car, that, you know, we were both kind of in that deepest place together and reflecting it back and forth to each other because of we've given ourselves the time to be together to allow it to happen. So that's enough for me. So now it's your turn. What are some things you've learned about how to nourish, fuel, feed a healthy interior life? What are some of your ways that you have? Yes? If you don't mind repeating that so we can pass this around. Camping, being in nature.
I like to journal and do drawings around intentions and what comes up in my dreams. I also have a dream journal, and there's a lot of stimulation from the inner world from dreams.
You need to turn it on. It's underneath the switch. Can we keep it on when people pass it around? Is it?
I like to listen to really nice classical music. And sometimes other music will do it for me, too.
I like to make music. I like to sing and dance.
Something I discovered recently was to ask myself whatever the question is that I seem to be facing, and then forget about it and let it work itself out.
In the spirit of what you shared about the morning, I find that if I can make it out the door without bending down and picking up the newspaper.
I like to read spiritual paragraphs. Mm-hmm. Books.
Thank you.
I find it really centering to be with animals and to kind of tune into them or kind of be at their level of consciousness or reality or time scale or whatever.
I don't know if I don't necessarily do it all the time. To not say thank you or not say I love you and just kind of feel it and like during the most intimate moments with whoever it be and feeling like you want to say I love you and sometimes holding that inside rather than just verbalizing it nourishes it.
Sometimes I do yoga. Ah. It's very spiritual. Sometimes I make a picnic lunch and have a lunch with friends out at a park nearby. Mm-hmm. Holding a baby or being around a little child, I work with children, so I get a lot of that during the day. And sometimes just going into the youngest infant classroom and just holding them and playing with them, being with them.
Going on retreat.
Over here, in the front.
Being in the garden, especially early in the morning or in the evening.
I like to march down Market Street with about 500,000 people waving flags and banners, speaking our minds.
I think sometimes driving and just turning music or anything off and just being in that moment of driving and just letting thoughts just go through and kind of reflecting on what's going on.
Mm-hmm. All the way in the back there.
I find the ocean is conducive to a lot of this. Mm-hmm.
Remaining silent when I think I might have something to say, just keeping quiet.
Right behind you.
Something that I find helpful is something Tan Jeff taught in one of his books called Keeping the Breath in Mind. And it lets me tune into the energy flows in my body and bring my breath and awareness deep inside me. And it does have the effect of energizing me and centering me, make me feel much more in tune with my life, and not so lost. So that's what I do.
So here, maybe the last one, back.
I like studying the Dharma.
So, I hope that each of you will nourish and enjoy something about your deep inner life, and that that deep inner life will manifest itself as something which helps everyone, all beings. May all beings be happy. Thank you.